Well, hello, CPC listener. Rachel, can you believe that we are at almost at 100 episodes?
Whoa, Nelly.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah. Whoa, Nelly is exactly the right thing to say. 100 episodes. That means we've recorded and we've skipped some weeks. So that means over 100 weeks.
Wow.
I don't even know how many.
It's almost 2 years.
How many minutes is that?
549. No, I was never good at math.
Anyway, we want to do something special for the 100th episode. Before we get started here, if you would call me at 650-349-1132 and press extension 117 and leave a voicemail of a testimonial of what this podcast has meant to you. We want to do something special for this episode. So it can be a funny story. It can be an anecdote. It can be a serious thing. Whatever it might be, we will want to hear from you. And if you do leave me a voicemail, you're also giving your consent to us putting you your voicemail on the podcast. Unless you say, don't put this part on the podcast. So do that. Help us celebrate 100 episodes. Whoa, Nelly. Here's the episode for this week. You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we talk about pretty much everything. So there is something pretty exciting that we found out this week.
Ooh.
That we have hit 5,000 downloads. Isn't that crazy?
Hey.
That's a lot of downloads. That's a lot of banter people have endured. That's a lot of banter.
I would love to hear the stats on the people that listen to the first 10 minutes and the people that fast forward through the 10 minutes.
Yeah. That would be fun.
Because you said that there are people that either love it or hate it.
Or hate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those that hate it have already fast-forwarded, by the way. Yeah. They're not even catching this.
But kudos to them for listening to the podcast, even though they hate the first 10 minutes.
They hate us having fun. That's the way I interpret it. Oh, man.
Gosh.
Yeah. Oh, man. So, but 5,000 downloads, that's just on, you know,
like podcasting apps, not the CPC app.
Yeah.
Which that's not bad.
I know.
They said we'd never make it.
And look, here we are. 12 listeners are stepping it up.
They're binging it on repeat.
Every week or so, I'll hear of one other person who like randomly stumbles upon it.
Yeah.
And they always go up like on this like binger of episodes.
That's awesome. And terrifying. Like that's a lot of us. It's a lot of us.
I never go back and listen. I've thought about it. Have you guys ever like gone back and like listened to?
I'll
like,
listen every once in a while. Not some of the old ones, but I rarely listen to the ones that I'm on. I love to listen to when Dan or Sandy's on Aaron.
I had to find your chewing one for my community group Friday. We tried to talk with like orange peels in our mouths. And then I was like, remember that one podcast episode? And they're like, podcast?
What podcast? Nice. A new pocket of listeners, right?
Did you go and play for them?
I couldn't find it.
What?
No. I couldn't remember what it was called.
It was like
certainly wasn't five by hand.
Oh my gosh.
That'd be great if that episode was
the most listened. I have a feeling it was the most avoided.
Negative 5,000.
Oh gosh. Yeah. It was too good.
Well, we started our new series on Sunday, the series of Job.
Job.
And I think...
I feel like we're obligated to make that joke. Like, we can't talk about Job this long without calling it Job. Like, it's a pretty core Christian-y joke.
Well, when Rachel asked you how you know that it's not called...
part of our job.
How it's not called Job, how you didn't really have a good answer.
I didn't, other than... Well, I did, actually. I'm almost positive it's the Hebrew. The Hebrew name, which I brought up. Let me see.
I think I just had that meme in my head of what if God said it was Jod and then walked away.
Yeah.
I think that's why.
It's pronounced Jod and then walked away.
Yeah, the Hebrew, it looks like it is Iyab, is how you'd say it in Hebrew.
Iyab.
So really, Iyab. It's closer to Job than Job.
Yeah, I guess so.
Do you have one of those little enunciators?
Iyab. I don't.
Yeah.
And my Hebrew is real rusty. Yeah, the phonetic spelling is E-E-Y-O-B-E, which would be Yob, because the E brings out the O.
E-E-Y-B-Y?
E-E-Y-O-B-E. Eob. The phonetic.
Eob.
Yeah, Eob. Because the E would bring out, the silent E brings out the O.
Wow. Uh-huh. So my question to start this
episode. Now the listeners are riveted. Now they're with us.
Yob.
I want to hear about one of your first Eobs. As you were growing up.
Sounds like a kid saying Eeyore.
Eeyore. Eob.
Oh, okay. My first job, I worked at a day. It was 4-H, but not the animal side. If you're familiar with 4-H, it was the daycare side. And I was the only male in the entire organization. And so it was a decent job. I essentially just kicked balls around and let kids chase them, like, for summer after summer. But part of being the only male at the whole place meant any of the field trips that we did, like, I had to do the not fun part, where it was like, we're going to Donner Lake, and they're like, one of the leaders has to be in the water, and it's like 12 degrees, and so it's like, well, Kevin will do it. And my gosh. So like another time, we had like the police come, and they did a demonstration with their German Shepherd, their dog or whatever, and they're like, well, we want one of the leaders to put on the bite suit. And it's like, literally they all looked around like, Kevin would love to. So I'm like in literally a bite suit, and they had this dog just attack me. Like, it was... Ew, it was a headache.
But every time I hear childhood stories, I feel like I understand more why you went into like a scholastic, like respected, revered position. Like, if I'm a doctor, they're not going to make me do youth stuff anymore. I don't have to play games.
I won't have to put on a bite suit. I won't have to swim after the beach ball.
I've never heard of such a thing before.
Yeah, it was wild, and it was terrifying.
The bite suits are crazy because you feel how strong the dog
is. Oh my gosh. I mean, they literally, and the dogs are so well trained. Like, they had the dog stand in front of me, and then they riled them up with some, and they're all German commands they give to these dogs. And they're just like, and this dog is gnashing the teeth, like, terrifying. And then they say, go, or whatever it was. And he sprints after me, and he jumps and attaches to the bite suit on my arm. And they said, do whatever you want, try to get him off. And I would swing him as hard as I could, and he would not let go. It was insane. But then the moment they said, nein, which is now no in German, the dog just stopped and sat there and said, okay, now you can pet him. And I was able to like pet him. Like, it was terrifying.
How confusing for the dog.
No.
Like, okay, first of all, you want me to kill this dude.
Now you want him to pet me.
Now you let him pet me.
It was terrifying. It was awful.
Wow. That reminds me of like, there's some movie, I forget, where they practice tasing and they let someone be like the practice.
Get tased.
Yeah. I feel like it was Zach Galifianakis.
That sounds like a Zach Galifianakis movie. Or who am I thinking of?
Ferrell.
Will Ferrell, thank you. I was thinking Forte, but that wasn't it.
All right, Rach, let's hear.
First job was probably babysitting, but outside of that, it was a one-day stint. I think I told this story in a dry cleaning store. But
one
I got
day?
Fired the Wait, same day.
I don't remember.
The same day?
I have not heard this story
yeah,
yet.
This is excellent.
It was this elderly Korean lady who we would take our like dry cleaning to every now and then. And I really wanted a job. Like, I kept telling my parents, I'm like, I want a job. They're like, you don't need a job. I'm like, but I want one.
Yeah.
So they let me get a job. It was a summer job. And I went in for the first day and she's like, all right, we'll train you. We'll have someone here the whole time and we'll pay you for the training. And you can work here the whole summer. There was not someone there the whole time. Everything was in Korean. And I was like, oh, okay. She's like, hit this button when people come in, tally up the number of clothes, spin the little rotator thing around, like give people their clothes. And I'm like in this dry cleaning store by myself. I get 7 orders. I think I've done a great job. I'm getting ready to close. I'm like, wow, that was a great first day. I get home. I didn't even lock the store. I don't even know who did. But
I'm going to swing by and lock it up.
You're like, man, I am good at this.
I thought I was. I get home and this lady's like yelling at my mom on the phone. And my mom's like, you have to pay her. She's like, no, I'm not paying her. She ruined all my orders. I don't know where anything is. And she was like, well, you left my daughter alone in a store. Like, she's under 18. And the lady was like, no, I'm not going to pay her. And then she's like, fine, I'll pay her, but I never want to
see her again.
She's not working here anymore.
Do you guys still go to the dry cleaners? Let's say
this was in Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. So. Yeah, that makes sense.
Wow.
That's wild.
Mrs. O.
That's awesome. Not
did you have to do any? Did you have to do any of the cleaning?
She's one of the 5,000 downloads.
No,
did you just
God.
Take the orders?
I took the orders. I wrote down like, oh, pants, shirts. What I thought said pants because it was Korean. But
you didn't write pants. You wrote underwear.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I love the fact that whoever that sweet lady was couldn't look at the piece of clothing and then make the adjustment. Oh, this isn't underwear. It is a shirt. Like that's wild.
I think it just like rang up the wrong totals and their register was old, but
and then
babysitting
your career
was it.
And dry cleaning was done.
That was done.
That was it.
And then I set my sights on Ross.
Yeah.
And then I never worked there. Still pipe dream.
How did you take that news when you got home and the lady was not happy with your fine work?
I was kind of offended that she left me alone in the store, but kind of grateful I didn't have to go back. If she hadn't paid me, I think I would have been a little salty. But
did you have to go back for your check?
No, I think my mom went for me.
That's nice.
That was nice. I don't think I could drive yet either. So,
wow, that's three
a good
in
story.
The fire. Yeah.
That's a really good like first job story. That's really good.
Trust me with your dry cleaning orders, or don't.
Brandy,
my favorite job growing up before I like got a real job was, I think I've told you this, children's birthday parties. That was the best.
Yes.
And that was actually the only time I ever came to the peninsula, because those are the people that had the money to hire a performer for their kids.
And did you just do music? Did you do balloon animals?
No, it was a whole thing.
Tell me you did balloon animals.
I did balloon animals.
Magic?
Yes.
Yeah, no magic.
Oh.
So you could make a sword right now? You could make a little hat out of balloons?
Yeah, I can make a lot of stuff. I still have the skills.
Why have we not tapped into this? Why has this not been Sunday morning?
But
sword drills.
Next birthday party.
Call Brandon. Go for an hour.
For my birthday
sword
party.
Drills?
I want. That was a slow hitter. For my birthday, I want Brandon to make me balloon animals.
All right.
Scripture habit's going to get wild with those sword drills.
If you want anything like to like specific for me to make, outside of.
A Dachshund for sure. I want the dog, the wiener dog.
Easy, yeah.
Definitely
I can
that.
Make a poodle. The poodle's pretty
interesting. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, okay.
I can make a parrot that sits on your shoulder.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, a hat. Some crazy hats I can make.
I love the idea. Like, in my mind, like once a month, you pull the stuff out in practice. Like, just to keep it alive. You know what I mean?
I'd Not like once to a think month, that. But probably once a year, someone will ask me to do something.
It's amazing.
And you have to have certain...
Well, I am going to now ask you once a year, every year. For the rest
there's a certain brand that you need to get, because otherwise they pop all the time.
Did your fingers get tired?
No, because you use a pump to blow it up, and then
but
you
still
just,
all the little tie-in and stuff.
It's
but so, your finger, you're a musician, man. Your fingers are ready for that.
These babies are the money makers, as I like to call them. But we would do a show, and they couldn't advertise Disney names. So they would like say like the Sheriff Cowboy or whatever, and I would be Sheriff Woody. It would be like, you know, some kind of princess.
Does Barmstrong or something like it.
Yeah. Napping pretty.
Yeah.
Napping pretty. So we would just show up and do a whole show, and it would be like the 30-minute show would be like singing. It'd have like a whole act, like a script.
Yeah.
You act and interact with the kids. And the guy who wrote them was really funny. And so you'd get the adults laughing and that kind of stuff. And then you hang out with the kids, like do balloon animals. Or you can face paint, but I can't. I couldn't face paint.
Yeah, you were a balloon guy.
Yeah, I was a balloon guy.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But it was great. I was like one of my most favorite shows. And most of the time, the kids are terrified. Like the thing they want most in life is to see Sheriff Woody. And then they see him like a life-size version of Sheriff Woody. And it's too much for them and they run and hide.
Yeah.
So
did I ever tell you
them,
that I once so my parents owned a Christian bookstore for years?
Salty?
No, me. Not salty.
Salty showed up here,
but it was I was Larry the Cucumber.
Oh my god!
Like the
gosh.
Official Whoa. Sanctioned.
Can you please find a picture?
I will have to.
Is there a picture that exists?
But it was
that?
Like an 8-foot-tall costume, and then my friend Madeline was Bob the Tomato, and we weren't allowed to say anything because, like, you know, we didn't have their voice or whatever. And it was the same thing. Kids would be absolutely terrified of us. Just like absolutely terrified. But yeah, I think it was the release of Oh, Jonah? I think it was the Jonah movie. I think yes, it was the Jonah movie.
The best one.
Now we had this big old to-do, and we were Bob and Larry.
VeggieTales, it's pretty, it was
scarring?
Pretty genius.
Oh, yeah, yeah, genius. Yeah, yeah. That also.
Was it scarring for you? You didn't like it?
Yeah. I didn't like them. I think it was because I was around it so much. There's working out some, I don't know, some trauma.
Spiritual lowercase
some small tea,
trauma.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Well, I wanted to set up Lent a little bit because we kicked off the Lent season on Ash Wednesday. We did our first ever service, so shout out to anyone who might have come at 6:30 a.m. on Wednesday. Those are the super Christians right there.
Totally.
But that kicked off the Lent season.
Yeah.
And you have said before to us that you don't want people to be surprised by Easter.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Explain a little bit about what you mean by that and what kind of maybe the benefits of us leaning into the church calendar more than we have in the past.
Yeah. I think as, at the intro of my sermon this past Sunday, I talked about a little bit about the church calendar and how Easter is the high point of the church calendar. It is our greatest celebration. It's the center point of all the hope that we hold. I mean, that's Paul in Corinthians, right? When he says, if Christ wasn't resurrected, then we're chief to be pitied. Like, we're the most to be pitied. And so Easter is really the orienting event of our entire lives as Christ followers. And so I find that one of the responsibilities as a pastor and as, I think, lead and teaching pastor is that like when someone says they're surprised, like, oh my goodness, I can't believe it's Easter. That I know what they mean by that, but that feels like a bit of a dereliction of duty for me as the pastor to say we shouldn't be surprised by the high point of our calendar, right? Like the biggest moment, the biggest anchor point of our hope, of our faith. And by following at least the historic church calendar, the liturgical calendar, there's rhythms to it that help us to not be caught off guard by that, that I think are actually, there's a lot of wisdom in following these. It isn't something that is demanded, nor do you, quote, have to, like many churches don't. And I think that's perfectly fine. There's nothing that says you have to celebrate these sorts of events or seasons. But I think, again, what historically the church has developed this practice of the church calendar out of a wisdom of saying we can rehearse the story of God throughout the very year that we live through. And in that, when you prepare in a season of Lent for Easter, it allows a season to both kind of reflect on the high points of the Christian life and the low points of the Christian life. But in all of it, you're kind of reorienting the way you spend your time towards Jesus. Mm. So it becomes like impossible to, like if you just think again about like living in these different seasons, it actually reorients the whole of who you are. Like it keeps Jesus before your mind in some ways if you're processing a season like Lent. And it's subtle. It's nothing like necessarily overt, but it's enough to like when we enter into that season, it aims my life, it aims my attentiveness a little bit more towards Jesus. And then in particular, it leads us, I think, in a way in which we can prepare to celebrate something as profound as Easter. The two high seasons, right, are Lent leading to Easter, Advent leading to Christmas. And if you think about the way that, you know, we anchor our calendar, our lives as Christ followers, those two events are really paramount. And so the church calendar affords us an opportunity, I think, to prepare for that in a way that I think there's just wisdom to it. I have found much life in kind of observing those or starting to kind of play around with observing those seasons.
There's a kind of a sentiment that I've heard from a lot of different people that when they're going through hard stuff, that's when they want to not go to church.
Mm.
Because there's this vibe that when you go to the church, everything should be buttoned up. Everything should be happy. Everybody's wearing their Sunday best.
Yeah.
The preacher's given some kind of encouraging message.
Yeah.
So if someone comes up and says, how are you? And you tell them life is horrible right now and it's really hard and this is blowing up or that's blowing up, it feels like it's not a safe place to be. So I think it's safe to say that like church is not always, and not necessarily CPC, but because I think CPC is leaning in, learning to do this better, but church has not always been a good place for lament.
Yeah.
And I'll just never forget a conversation. I told you guys about this, that the conversation I have with a worship leader who said, there's really no place for lament in our Sunday services. There shouldn't be, was his argument.
Yeah.
And, you know, to him, a church service Sunday morning is really all about celebration. And if you're doing some kind of lament activity or you're trying to go internal on that, it ruins the celebration. It kind of puts a damper on the party.
Yeah.
The wet blanket.
Yeah.
And I just remember hearing that and something in my soul was like, that doesn't seem...
doesn't feel right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah.
Is he right?
I don't think he's right. But to maybe affirm a little bit of like the goodness in what he is saying, though, is the point that what we celebrate at Easter is, I mean, the most profound life, world history reorienting event ever. And so I think in that, there's in some way, I want to say there's a good impulse in that of just saying we have the most reason to be joyous and to hope in the work of Jesus. So like that is absolutely true. I think where maybe he's a little off base is just that that's not the human experience, though. Like the reason we celebrate is because we live in the overlap of heaven and earth right now, right? We talked about that in Colossians. And in that overlap, there's a lot of death and pain. And, you know, I tend to find, particularly around Easter, when we start quoting Paul in Corinthians, where he says, oh, death, where's your sting? And he seems to be taunting death. We forget that that's a future forward speaking. Like it's not about here and now we say that. We will say that, oh, death, where's your sting? But right now, death does sting. We do experience death and brokenness. We do, in fact, feel the fallout of the world. And so the human experience is full and robust in that we experience sadness and brokenness and death and sin. And then we also hold in tension, though, the resurrection. And that's, I think, the wisdom of the church calendar is it goes through seasons in which you experience the full gamut of that. And I wouldn't look any further than Jesus, right, to experience this. Like, you see the way Jesus laments. Like, even, you know, you see it in the high points, Garden of Gethsemane on the cross, of course, where he's crying out. But think of even the time when he looked down at Jerusalem and he's like, he was weeping over the city because of its brokenness. Mm-hmm. And he was looking at with Jerusalem, like, why are you this way? Or will you always be like this, right? And so even in the life of Jesus, he was living in that overlap of both heaven that's there now, the kingdom of God is here, but yet this present age governed by sin and death that's dying off. So he felt that sting. And so you see him lament. I mean, go to the Psalms. 2/3 of the Psalms are lament Psalms. Mm. It's about giving voice to the deepest brokenness that we have. Of course, in view of resurrection, but I don't think you have to exchange one for the other. Like you have to... The Lord wants us to bring that depth of brokenness, that mortality that we do have. Like all of us are in fact going to die. Like I think that's part of what we miss. Like death is a very real reality for every one of us. And that's part of, for the Christian, that's not ultimate as it is for those who don't believe in resurrection. But for us, it's part of it becomes then a natural part of the life cycle. Mm-hmm. In which we die and will be resurrected. So it gives a different tone, but it doesn't make it hurt any less. And I think for a church to not give voice to lament, I don't know how it makes sense of reality. I don't know how you actually make sense of lived experience. Cause life is broken. I mean, that was the point Sunday, right? Life east of Eden is terrible. And it wasn't supposed to be terrible, but it is. And we don't have to flinch when we say that. Like it really is. It is terrible. There's all sorts of hope and joy, of course. But cancer sucks. You know, divorce is not great. Broken friendships are awful. Like all that stuff are very real realities, and we don't have to avoid that. The Christian story has room for us to bring that grief, and the Lord wants to meet us in that.
And I think all of our hope is that this would be a safe place for you to bring your laments.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where you can join. There's kind of comfort in knowing that we're all in some way, in some place in our life, going to relate to that,
mm-hmm.
Kind of lament.
And the wisdom and consistency of a practice like Lent or Advent that can feel rote, like no doubt, like, and it can turn into that where you just walk through the motions and all that, of course. But there's something in like the repetitive nature in which you remember, oh yeah, I am dust and to dust I shall return. Like having that vocabulary and that language available, I think is important, whether or not you're in that season or not. Because at a, you know, even at a church our size, like we couldn't in every Sunday, you know, whether, you know, discern if it's supposed to be a joyous or a sad, lamentful, you know, kind of filled Sunday. Because the reality is in that room, there's a range of experiences of what that week brought them. And so in that, organizing our time in where we come through these seasons, I think helps us to build a vocabulary of what do I do in those moments. Mm-hmm. And if you've never heard the words that you are dust and to dust you shall return, the words of Ash Wednesday, it's hard to have that available when you are in fact feeling mortality, feeling the effects of brokenness and sin. So I think that's part of it, is we're building out language, ways of interpreting the brokenness of the world, so that when you're in that season, you have something to lean into.
So Job actually is a pretty good book. I think everyone would agree after listening to that message. It's a pretty good book for lament.
Yeah.
Certainly understanding that, like, all of us at some point, like you said, are going to experience some level of loss, suffering, or where God doesn't meet our expectations. So I think it's a good choice. Good job. Is that you who chooses all of that?
I did choose that.
Wow.
Good job.
Let me soak in that moment.
Let's take
good
a moment.
Job.
Say it again. Blind squirrel finds an egg every once in a while.
Job is the oldest book that we have, right?
There's some debate around that, but yes, it's believed to be like 3,000 years old. So coming from behind, before the time of Moses, at least in the writings. So
wow,
but that's contested. But it's old. It's old.
I wonder which guy contests that. It's like, you know what? This is inaccurate information. I'm going to contest that. Anyway.
Welcome to biblical scholarship.
Yeah.
We contest those kinds of things. Yeah. Of which I am not a biblical scholar, by the way.
When you have your doctorate, are you going to be a biblical scholar?
I do not study biblical studies. I study theology, which is different. Theology is built off biblical studies. But biblical studies is all this kind of grunt work of, you know, this translation and this tense and this, that yada, yada, yada. That's the work that I love to use the work of biblical scholars, but I don't want to do the work of biblical scholarship.
In the hierarchy of all of the Bible scholar theology
nerd
world, who is like a higher rank?
Well, I mean, that's... You're essentially going to say who's the favorite child, right? Like, okay. As a theologian, I'm going to claim theology. Talk to any biblical scholar, they're going to say a biblical scholarship. Okay, but it's so essentially like...
It's like a doctor, like different doctors.
Yeah. But think of it in the terms of like, biblical scholars provide the material for theology to theologize.
Mm.
Theology is like the grammar of the biblical world. It's how things operate and connect together and interact with one another. It's also a little more aimed at applied, which is really where my field is. I'm more trained in ethics, theology and ethics, than just biblical scholars. But it is a distinction. Not a lot of people know that. Biblical scholars are very technical. Theologians aren't as technical. They're learning how do these concepts and ideas play out in real life and interact with one another and all that. And we've now lost all of our listeners at this distinction of what...
No, I mean, like inaugurated eschatology, right?
Am I right?
But I am curious, as a theologian, how you would talk about... I want you to unpack this idea that it's... you said poetry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's not maybe the poetry that everybody thinks about.
Yeah.
But explain a little bit of the different literary...
Yeah.
Functions.
Yeah. So ironically, this would actually be more in the biblical scholars realm. So a biblical scholar could speak to this more specifically. And really what we're looking at is the concept of how do we interpret things, which is the field of hermeneutics. So how do we interpret a text? One of the most important factors in interpreting a text is its genre, meaning what kind of writing is it? And so think of it like the best way to think of it in a modern kind of parlance is we're going to read a news article different than we're going to read an email, different than we're going to read a text, different than we're going to read a love letter. Like all of those, we're going to engage our brain in a different mindset. Whereas something like a love letter, we're going to assume to see, which I don't think anyone writes anymore, by the way, but assume we do. You would assume to see some more flowery, poetic type language. Whereas if you approach a news article, you're going to expect and assume there's going to be factual data. There's going to be kind of more just a root. Here's what happened. Here's when it happened. Here's all those things that happened. those are very different modes in which we interpret. And so when we come to the book of Job, whose genre is really epic, it is epic poetry in the sense of, I think the way I liken it like to Macbeth, or think of even like the Iliad, you know what I mean? Like Homer's Iliad, like that's epic poetry. It's long stories that are narrative, they're stories, but they're communicated in poetic form, which means I have to understand that the author may or may not be communicating a literal thing. Because it's poetry, right? Like all of us understand poetry is different than a narrative, you know, and those sorts of things. And so when we come to Job, we have to recognize that's what's happening in it, which just honestly is just a really long way to say it's really complicated to interpret. Mm-hmm. One of the harder books to interpret because of the poetic nature of it.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the very top of this for a second and just ask you maybe some questions.
Yeah.
Starting at this, what you called the courtroom scene, it says, one day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, Satan also came with them.
Yeah.
And then, and for me, seemingly out of nowhere, the Lord said to him, where have you come from?
Yeah.
Satan answered, you know, I've been roaming around the earth, back and forth on it. And then, oh, this is the out of nowhere part. Have you considered my servant Job?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, I'm Job and I'm reading that after the fact.
Yeah.
I'm like, what the heck?
God. Like,
dude, all I was doing was just doing being, I was just being good, just being a good dude.
Yeah.
What's
planting
happening there?
Yeah.
Like, is God just being like,
is he just making a wager with the devil?
Yeah.
And
what
playing
the heck?
With Job as his pawn. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really good. And I think we did. I'm glad we came back to this because we got a little ahead of ourselves in that last conversation. But that is, in fact, it's important to note, because what's happening in the early language in the prologue is that it is, in fact, a courtroom scene. Like, that's everything is pointing to this is what's happening here. And so when the angels or the sons of God are presenting themselves to God, it isn't just them appearing before God. Hey, here I am. The imagery, the language, all of the metaphor that's playing out here is all signaling that these angels were co-ruling the earth with God, which is, in fact, what happens. Again, that's going back. On Sunday, I went back to Genesis and reminded us that that's part of what God has done from the early creation story, is given us a level of free will in which we are called to steward the earth, rule over the earth in the way that God would have us rule. And that's what it means to bear that image of God, is we're literally ruling in the way that our image bearer, or the one we're imaging, would, like God. In that then, so free will is now inserted into the picture, in which humans, and particularly the divine beings, the angels or the sons of God that we just read about, they have the choice to lean into the way of God or to rebel against God. And so what's happening in this opening courtroom scene is these divine beings are coming before God, and they're essentially communicating back. How's it going on earth? What's
status
happening?
Report.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a status report. And so imagine some are going, yeah, it's going well here, it's going well there. And then all of a sudden, within that context, you have this Hasatan, the Satan, which again just means adversary. I don't think at this point it's the Satan that we come to know in the biblical story as evil manifested in one particular being. That does exist, and that's a later development in the biblical story. Hmm. Right now, I think of the Satan, Hasatan, as simply a title. As the adversary. So hold to that courtroom metaphor. That isn't mine. It's the text metaphor that there's a courtroom scene going on.
So you could map the title onto almost anything. Like if we were playing tennis and you were my adversary, I could.
You could call me Hasatan. Yeah. But that is a really important point too, though, because like anything that opposes or is an adversary, that would be the word in Hebrew used to describe them.
Interesting.
So again, there is a distinct being known as, that we call the Satan or the devil, that does exist. I really do believe in the evil one, the individual. But as far as what biblical scholars would say at this point, that person has not developed in the story. And it could be that it was this person who became that.
Yeah.
But here it's, and that's why I say Hasatan in Hebrew. Ha is the word the. And so here it just says the adversary, someone who's opposing God. So he's in the scene. And this is, again, within that context in which God is fielding these status reports from these beings, the Satan is there and he's now giving his report. So it isn't so much that it's this weird question, but it's rather like in the same way that God was probably asking, hey, where have you been? What have you been up to? Give me that report. He looks at the Satan. He's like, well, where have you been? You know, and as the adversary, he's trying to push back against the things of God. And this is where I think when God says, have you considered Job? Like, where are you finding problems with him? He seems to be the perfect one. Have you connected with him? Things seem to be going well for Job. And that's when the Satan begins to make these accusations against God, which, you know, as I talk about Sunday, he looks at Job and he's like, of course that guy loves you. Look at the life he has. Look at everything you gave him. And that's where these accusations against God begin to take place of, you know, why wouldn't he love you? Like, do humans actually love you for you or only for the things you give them? And that's really the heartbeat of the question. And I think what is fascinating is we never know exactly why God took the wager, if you will. Why did God do this? We don't really know. He didn't need to prove himself to the Satan, but for whatever reason, he does entertain that. And even to your point earlier, if you're Job reading this, it's important to remember that Job never does, ever.
Yeah.
Like, he dies and he never, from the narrative we see, ever see that God entertained this. And it's important as we go to remind ourselves of that. Job has no idea what happened. We as the readers know something that Job doesn't.
There's a very popular song in the 90s. Do you remember The Bridge, Rachel? He gives and takes away.
Matt Redman, right? Oh, Matt Redman.
Yeah. Paul Beloche, I thought.
Oh, it was Matt Redman.
Or Matt Redman.
There were so many people.
Doubt my mid-90s worship knowledge.
We lived that, Rachel. Yeah. Okay.
I guess I just heard the covers. That's why I said Paul Beloche.
Every time I hear Paul Beloche, I think of Belushi, Jim Belushi.
Yeah.
The comedian, which is not Paul Beloche. But every time, that's who I think of. But
but there were so many people that when you were talking about this, with this point where Job gets, where he doesn't know the behind the scenes conversation, and he says, you know, God, you give and you take away. And you didn't necessarily, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you didn't actually say he doesn't ever take away. But in this situation, according to this text, God actually allows Hasatan to do what he's going to do, but God doesn't do it himself. So it almost sounded like you were saying he gives, but he doesn't take away, which would mean that we would have to change the bridge to that song.
We would definitely have to change that song a lot. Yeah. Or we sing it in a way that we understand that it's maybe factually true. Maybe
gives
not.
And maybe takes away, but we don't really know. Give.
Change it into a question. Does he give?
Yeah. That'd be better. That's good. But yeah, and that's one of the complicated things about the book of Job is between Job and his friends, they at times say very true good. They espouse good and true theology. Other times it's not. And that's true of any character in the Bible, with the exception, obviously, of Jesus. But like, there are times when again, this is where genre is important. Like, I think of the Psalms and the way they communicate raw human emotion. We wouldn't read those and think, yes, it's good to pray that God would bash the heads of my enemies' babies against the rocks. Mm. Like, we read that and we instinctually know this is a poetic form in which he's really lamenting and deeply communicating sorrow. And so this is where we have to complexify our understanding of the text. But from what Job understands, what Job knows, he makes a statement that we as the reader recognize isn't fully true. The Lord did not take away Job's family or his sheep or any of his house, all those sorts of things.
Or the camels.
The Satan did, right? And the Satan did. And I think this is where as this theme develops, we can often misplace when we get this wrong. And I think you're right in saying that there are times in which we see where God does, in fact, bring judgment by inflicting harm and suffering, or at least allowing it to happen. I think of maybe the biggest example or one of the biggest would be Israel when he allows the Babylonian Empire to come in and sends them into exile. I mean, specifically says, I will send you to exile if you don't shape up, more or less. To which they're sent into exile. So it isn't a black and white, God never does this, never does. But according to Job himself, in reflection, gets this, for my reading, wrong. from the text. God didn't take away. And I think the reason it's important is that we often associate our anger and frustration at circumstances to God when they should be at Hasatan. Mm. So Job's like anger and frustration the whole time, he's leveling at God. What have I done? Right? Because he holds it together here, but in a few chapters, chapter three, he comes undone. I mean, and it's a tragic poem that he bursts into, which we can understand given the circumstances why he would feel the way he did. But he begins to levy all of this anger at God. And to me, it exemplifies the beauty and the grace of God that he absorbs that, walks with Job, never like, you know, essentially discredits what he's going through. And often when we get into a simplistic way of understanding maybe the world and free will and evil, we level all these accusations against God that we don't know if they're true or not. And in that way, we have to remember that our anger should be at evil and at the Satan. And he's the one perpetrating this evil, and our sin is perpetrating evil. All of that brokenness is what's really the source cause of it. But we often look to God and say, God, why would you do this?
But is that really so? Is that really so crazy, though? I mean, if you think about, let's think about this organization here as a church. Okay, like let's say Rachel and I, we get like 12 of the staff together, and we're like, you know what? We are painfully underpaid. This is an epidemic at this place. We don't make enough money where we can barely afford rice. And so we start, and we're like, you know what? We need to blame someone. We're going to blame you. You're the boss. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that so wrong that we blame you? You're the guy who apparently has the control. Now, I know we have a leadership of elders here, but let's just go with me for a second.
Kevin has all the rice.
I got all the rice.
Yeah, like... Shouldn't we go to the one who has all the power and the authority with our upsetness, with our anger?
Yeah. With the exception of the fact that you, in your metaphor, have no category for Hasatan. Where in your story is the adversary who's wreaking havoc? Because think of it from the story of Genesis 1, right? God creates a beautiful world. He creates it perfect with harmony and flourishing with everything we would need. It's right there available. The humans are in there. And then in the midst of that story, when he creates the humans, he says again, I'm going to create you and I'm inviting you to be an image bearer, to co-rule this world with me. I want to love you. I want to be in a relationship with you and I want to co-create something with you. And in that, by creating the invitation to love, he creates the opportunity for choice. Because if you are to love, that has to be inherently I have to have the availability to not love you,
right?
In order to love. And so free will is then interjected in there. And so then at that point, the humans have the opportunity. Do I want to live according to God or do I want to live as if I'm God? This is the whole thing with the tree. Will they take from the knowledge of the good and evil? It's not that God was withholding knowledge. It's them saying, I'm telling you that this is not good for you. And are you going to trust and obey that I know what's right for you? And I'm the one who gets to decide good and bad, or maybe not even decide, but rather I'm the one who knows what is good and what is evil. And the humans take of the apple and therefore say, no. And it's the same question that the devil asked, you know, that Satan asked God, right? The serpent in Genesis says, does God really love you? Does he really know what's best for you? You know what's best for you. And so when the humans then take on that posture and they rebel against God, it isn't that God punishes them. It's that they're then trying to live with their wisdom and understanding of what is right and wrong. And that's where it goes haywire. And this is where you get something like you guys familiar with the concept of like chaos theory? He's a little like essentially like, you know, like that old adage that like a butterfly's wings on this side can create a hurricane on this side of the world.
Oh, yeah. Like, the
like where one
effect.
Decision impacts more than we could ever imagine.
Yeah.
That's what you see really in Genesis is sin is chaos theory. That's what I talked about in Genesis when God creates the world, right? It's that tohu vavohu. It's chaos. It's unreality. That's what's unleashed when humanity says, no, I'll be the arbiter of right and wrong. And we do that all the time, right? We say, no, God, I know he's instructed me this, but God doesn't know. If he knew my life situation, then that would be more important. And what we do over and over is release chaos theory over and over and over. Tohu vavohu, over and over. Mm. And when you get an entire humanity doing that, man, the effects of that are so interconnected and interwoven that they, I mean, to me, the utter brilliance and power of God to say, I will, like Romans says, I will take all of that brokenness. I didn't cause it, but all of that, and turn it for the good.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if there's something more beautiful and powerful. Mm-hmm. So I guess in bringing it back to your example, it would be in some ways that I created an environment in which I've invited you to work and so you can flourish. And here's how you do that. And you guys rebelled against that and therefore went downstream from that. But I'm really uncomfortable with me being God. I just want to say, but to stretch your metaphor, I think that's where I would say it. So, and this is the way I think I said it on Sunday, at least in first service, God is culpable insofar as he created beings with free will. That, and I think that is an utterly fair statement. And I think something that God says, that's what I chose to do for the sake of loving my humanity and what he desired. Mm-hmm. And then again, of course, the beautiful thing of this is that he actually takes on that humanity, takes it to the cross, suffers to reconcile that which he didn't cause, which is profoundly beautiful. But.
So one of the ways, places you land is this idea. I remember you said, like Job, like everyone else talks about God.
Yeah.
Something like that. And Job actually is the one that talks to God. Him. And you paint this picture of him really staying engaged in the midst of all of this suffering. Mm-hmm. And I guess in thinking about the problem of suffering and how often so many people that I know, when they hit that wall that we see Job hit, mm-hmm. they don't stay engaged. And I actually think if you're yelling and angry at God, that at least implies some engagement still, because you're still in the fight.
Yeah.
But I've seen so many people that they hit that point and they say, you know what? There's no way, like, any God that I can fathom that would be worth worshiping would never do anything like this. And they just kind of walk away. And this is maybe a bigger question than you can answer, but how do we stay engaged in the midst of suffering, and how do we help other people stay engaged without offering them seemingly, you know,
trite answers,
trite cliches, platitudes. You know what, you just need to draw closer to God. But when you're suffering in the depths of your despair, like, you know, anyway,
man, that's such a good question. And I should say, just to cover all of this with, I don't think anything we offer here has solved these questions that are at least 3,000 years old. They're as old as Job. And so anything I say, anything we say, is probably going to be far too complex or far too simplistic to really grasp the complexity of it all.
Woolly mammoths were dealing with this.
The old woolies. But I think it's a really good question of, like, how do you keep people engaged, or how do people stay engaged with God through suffering? I don't know. The first thing I keep coming back to is, like, this is why the church is so necessary. Like, you can't do it on your own. Like, you just can't. Like, I can't imagine walking through a season of suffering alone and it's sticking. Like, I need to come on a Sunday and I need to hear the voices of other people sing truth that I can't sing. You know what I mean? Like, I need to sit in the room and hear people sing about the goodness of God when I can't bring myself to even fathom that God's good. And so there's something to that discipline of community, which the church hasn't always stewarded well, right? Like, I think there's a part we have to own where we've been scared off by doubts, by questions, and at times haven't been able to really welcome those kinds of deep places. I think that gets back to what we talked about at the beginning of the need for lament, the need for a season like Lent to understand the full range of the human experience. But that's my first thought, is you really can't do this alone. And then I think maybe the second piece, and I'll actually want to hear your guys' perspective on it too, would just be a healthy dose of recognizing we're a multi-thousand year old tradition. And any question we have is not the first time we've asked that question. The church has wrestled with, I would argue, every question you could think of, or at least some variation of it. And so whatever doubt or question you have, man, there's somewhere in our tradition where we have wrestled with this. People who are brilliant, I mean, brilliant minds, have wrestled with, people who have this deep passion for loving God have wrestled with these things. So you aren't alone in that. We don't necessarily have answers, but know that you're not alone in questioning those things. But how would you guys, that's a really good question. Like, how do you guys invite people to cling to God in the midst of their kind of pain and suffering?
We kind of talked about this a little bit as a community group, but one of the discussion questions was, what keeps you from talking to God instead of talking about God? And I think some of that is being okay with not having the answers. Like, I think my answer to that was that sometimes I try to rationalize what God is doing.
Yeah.
Whether that's like my view of God is of him being good, or maybe a not so true view of God.
Yeah.
But then that doesn't actually help me go to God. That actually keeps me further away because I've put him in a box in some ways. So I think having the quick answers, or if I look to someone else to rationalize it when I feel like I can't, that makes it harder for me to go to God because I have a simple answer, which is maybe what I thought I wanted, but it's not the space that I needed to just sit in it for a while.
Yeah.
Like we were saying in our group that if you were to hear some tragic news, it would take probably a really long time to get to the point where you're like, okay, I can still trust that God can work with this, but you don't just like, I don't know. We talked about how our first response isn't falling down in worship, which is hard to do, but it takes, I think, some space. So I think maybe not even having any answers, but just space for people to sit.
Yeah.
That's helpful for me, at least. I don't know.
Which is what the friends get right. And we'll see that this week is they do, at first they come and for 7 days, they just sit with Job and nobody says a word. And I think that's actually a really good posture when we have loved ones who are suffering. I tend to just barge in with words, and I have to constantly like remind myself, just hold space, just hold room for the person to be. And you don't have to say, you don't have to have the answers. But Job's friends get that right. They get it wrong really quickly after that and they go off the rails. Yeah. But there is that, the comfortability with the tension is kind of what I heard you saying of like, how do I sit with the unknown? It's hard.
Yeah. I think, you know, hearing you talk, Rachel, like I'm reminded of how important our view of God is and how much that comes into play when suffering hits.
Yeah.
And I was thinking this morning, like our view, whoever we are, theologian or whatever, is most likely some percentage wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like we don't know. Very like good. There's so much mystery to God.
Yeah. That's
and
good.
So to walk away in the midst of when God doesn't meet an expectation or doesn't deliver the way that we think he should. I wouldn't say this to someone who's suffering, but it is a bit arrogant.
Yeah.
You know, because it assumes that you've got who God should be figured out.
Yeah.
And that's not the case. But when I watched my community group talk about this on Monday, we had some beautiful sharing of people talk about moments in their lives when God didn't act the way that, where God didn't deliver the way that they almost knew that he would, and how it broke something in them. And we talked about that, and it was this really sweet, vulnerable, hard moment that kind of brought us all closer together. But as we started unpacking it together, I realized one of the benefits of the community that you're talking about, of being part of the church, is not just that you have a buddy with you in the suffering. Mm. It's that you have other people that have also been let down, quote unquote, and have seen God deliver on the other side.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe the most powerful thing, is that lived experience that when we go through something and God brings us through kind of this huge thing, you know, like think about the lived experience that Job would have had once this is all said and done. Yeah. Like, oh, your cat just died. I'm sorry that your cat just died. Let me tell you about my lived experience with the last. I had 10 camels on a hill, you know. But I think that's such a huge part of community, and like you said, with the songs, it's in a way that's what we're doing with singing too, is reminding ourselves God has delivered before.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't stop now just because in this moment you can't see how he's going to make this something beautiful.
You know, one of the things that, again, is not one that I would communicate to someone in the midst of suffering, but when you're not in a place of suffering that you it's good to remember, is I don't know of a better engine for maturity than suffering. Like when I talk to anyone who's followed Jesus for any amount of time, suffering seems to be the place in which God does some of the greatest growth and transformation. And the only thing I can map it onto is like the vows that you say at a wedding, for rich or for poor, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. Like those take on a significant more weight now, me 15 years into marriage than on day one, where day one I believed it. Right. But the intimacy and the maturity I have in my relationship now with Lindsay, wildly different and more rich than it was at day one, because we've had to wrestle with richer and poorer, sickness and in health. Thankfully, not till death do us part, but we've taken our licks. And that's similar in the way that we mature with the Lord. Like there is like suffering, I don't believe is imposed in the same way that Lindsay wouldn't impose suffering on me. But there is something about suffering that God uses, again, go back to Romans, for the good of those who love him, for our formation, in which he'll take whatever the heinousness of that situation, like there's an opportunity for growth on the other side of that, if we hold on. And ultimately, I think the message of Job, which is tipping my hand a little bit, is that God is communicating that there are no simple answers. Going back, Rachel, to what you were saying, there is no simple answer. The world is far, far more complex. The effects of sin is far, far too complex. And the invitation is to trust that God is operating the world in such a way that makes sense to his character. We won't understand, and you never lead with that, because again, that's not in the midst of suffering, but it's the world is more complex, and the invitation is to trust in God's character and who he is, and that he's walking along with us.
So then you said the posture of when we're in the midst of suffering, our posture is really important. How would you, if you were going to give a couple words to describe what our posture, based on what we just said, is it like expectant that God will reveal himself in the process? Do we lean into the pain knowing that it's going to bring growth? Like, how would you?
Yeah, it's a really good question.
I'm full of those today.
You are good. Full of those today. I'll go back a little bit. And I shared a little bit on Sunday that this past year has been a season of, it's been a little bit of a season of suffering and a season that I didn't anticipate, a desert season that I didn't see coming. And it's hard to share this because I feel like for the appropriateness, it needs to be somewhat vague. But I think what's been different for me walking through it is it has been a lot more unknown than I'm used to. And I really do think that I'm on the other side of this. And this is talking a little bit with a therapist and a spiritual director I see, who it seems like I'm doing really good now. It's really stuff that happened much earlier in this, you know, about a year ago. But what's interesting is I didn't ever know the end. I didn't know if there was going to be an end. There was a lot of God. I just eventually getting to the point of like, God, it's dry. The initial pain of what happened has subsided. And now we're just on the other side of this thing. And it feels empty. It feels hollow. It feels like, I don't know. And the words I kept getting was just another step at a time. Just do the next thing. Just do the next thing. And thankfully, the grace of God has been that. And I would in no way say that he was there every moment and it felt like I knew exactly what was happening. It was a lot of I don't know. And so maybe when it gets back to that posture, I think what I've learned looking back is a posture of humility, of learning like, man, you can't rationalize your way out of it. That's me as an academic. I just want to think my way out of everything. And then, the thing that was really new for me was I think for the first time, maybe in my life, I got to a place where I could actually be totally honest with God, where I could like I cussed at God. You know what I mean? Like I've never done that in my life. That's really scary for me to actually do that. Like genuinely, but I got to that place where I got to the freedom I felt to just cuss at God. To God, this sucks. And I don't think it should be. I said different words, but that sense of like that raw honesty. And I don't want to say that was the magic bullet, but I feel like I relate to God differently now on the other side of that honesty. And I think that's important. And I think that's part of that posture is how do you get to the place where you can be honest with God, and that's a good thing. And it's scary to be that honest with God, but I think it's important.
And I have also experienced that when he meets you in the midst of that suffering and you start understanding kind of how you closed that he is a God who chose to suffer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know that's, you're going to go there in this series, but that may be, you know, something that is healing in the midst of the pain that as you walk through this and you find that God is walking through it with you, he's not just, he knows what you're
aloof going. And distant. Yeah. He's felt that state.